Let's talk a bunch of different topics.
How'd her career get there?
This is a podcast with Lauren Asghari.
Welcome to the Lauren Asghari podcast, How'd Her Career Get There? And my guest today is Rahel Bear, who is the owner of the Bear Group. So welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to have you here and thrilled to get into it. So let's kind of start with present day and then we'll go backwards a little bit. But let's open up a little bit, talk in broad strokes what the Bear Group is.
Sure. So the Bear Group works with youth-facing organizations, places like schools and camps, faith-based organizations, as well as does a lot of work in the corporate sector on creating really safe spaces, navigating both abuse and harassment prevention, and putting in place really good policies, but also really good workshops and trainings and conversations about what it means to truly create a safe space in each of those environments.
So I'm fascinated about how you got into this work. So we're going to get to that. let's back up to when you were a little kid. Give a little bit of context, like, where are you from? How many siblings? Sure. Where'd you grow up? What was your personality like as a kid?
Well, I am an eldest child, and I feel like that probably just defines me in a lot of ways. But I grew up in the tri-state area. I grew up in New Jersey. And I think what's so interesting is that as a young child, I was very, very shy. And I clearly grew out of that at some point. But I grew up the eldest daughter of two educators and spent a lot of my childhood, you know, navigating the complexities of both being a kid, but also the awesomeness of that. And I think that one thing that my parents really instilled in me was this idea of doing good in the world in the way that works for you. Right? What it means to actually add value in a way that speaks to you. And so I think that, you know, I probably speak for all of my siblings when I say we all picked different paths and we all picked paths where we were adding value in a meaningful way to each of us. And so that was a lot of my childhood.
And when you were a kid, did you think, like, what did you want to be when you, I always air quote when I ask this question, when you grow up, right? What did you aspire to? Was there like a particular career field that you were interested in, like as a kid, or you were just kind of, I'll figure it out, but I know I want it to be in this vein of putting good into the world.
Yeah. I mean, as a kid, I wanted to be a Broadway star because I was a musical theater kid and I was like, I definitely want to be on Broadway. Right. And that was something, you know, I spent a lot of my childhood and a lot of my teenage years doing theater and singing and really being able to like express myself in a very artistic way. But the truth is that by the time I got to college, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. I just knew that I wanted to do something that I was passionate about. And so I spent a lot of, you know, my college life kind of thinking about where are the avenues that I am both most interested and what is it that I could do. I never intended to go to law school, and I am definitely not someone who spent my life thinking, oh, I'm totally going to be a lawyer. Like, that was not me. I was the person who like watched Law and Order and was like, I would never want to do that. So it's ironic that I ended up doing that. But yeah, I just, you know, I wasn't so focused my whole childhood or teenage years on what are you going to do. It was much more about who are you going to be.
And when you went to, what did you study in your undergrad? And would you describe yourself as a academic child, right? Somebody who thrived in the academic world?
So I'll answer that second one first. I was definitely not someone who thrived in the academic world. I always loved learning. I had a thirst for learning, with the exception of a couple of subjects that were just unenjoyable to me. And I was a very big reader. I really liked history. I liked being able to see how certain puzzle pieces were put together. But I was not an overly academic kid. I was not the kid who always got straight A's. I was not the kid who, you know, school just automatically came easy to me. It was definitely not, you know, that was not kind of my childhood trajectory. When I ended up in college, I actually switched my major a lot of times because I really wanted to major in psychology, but the university that I went to at the time had a kind of calculus and statistics requirement for the psychology major. And I was scared of calculus. I had really struggled when it came to math, and I was just scared of it. And so there was a part of me that was like, let me find every other major that I can major in aside from psychology, because I'm scared of this one class. And in the end, I ended up majoring in psychology and I took the calculus requirement and everything was fine. I had to get over that hurdle and really, you know, make sure that I was setting myself up for success. So I majored in psychology and I did a focus on women and gender studies. And I also had a minor in Judaic studies. So I ended up having so many credits in a variety of different things that there were like a lot of, there were a lot of like major, minor, you know, and focuses. So that was my undergrad trajectory.
And then did you go near, I know you grew up in the tri-state area. Did you go to college in the same area or did you go?
Yeah, I went to Rutgers University. And it was actually great for me. It was a really fabulous place at a really fabulous time. Met great people, had wonderful professors, great classes, clearly in a variety of different subjects. And really, really enjoyed my time there a lot.
And then how do you go from a psychology degree with, and understood that you took some other courses maybe around the law, but then what was kind of the path that took you to go into law school or having an interest in that? Sure. And what type of law?
Yeah, I don't think I took a single law class in undergrad, to be totally honest. Really, it was not in my frame of reference that that's what I was going to do. I took some time off after I graduated from Rutgers, and I worked at a nonprofit. And I was really focused on kind of riding the wave of having focused on psychology. I was looking into a lot of different PhD programs. I kind of assumed that because I had built up my undergrad resume of so much in the psychology world, that it was a natural progression of what are you going to do and how are you going to add value? And the truth is, I remember having, you know, a lot of these applications to different programs on my dining room table, right? Like they were all spread out. I was newly married. And I remember like my husband looking at all of them and I was looking at all of them. And I just remember thinking like, I don't know that I want to do this. And you don't apply to a PhD program if you don't want to do that. And so I ended up having a conversation, probably multiple conversations with my father. And, you know, talking with him about like why I was hesitant and where what I should do and where I should go. And at one point he turned to me and he said, you know, Rachel, it sounds like what you're describing is that you want to do more advocacy than anything else, that it's not for you about, you know, always needing to listen and hear and just be present to help individuals. It almost sounds like you're looking for something on a broader scale. He's like, have you ever considered law school? And I was like, no, I have never considered law school. And he was like, maybe you should consider that. I was like, you don't go to law school on a whim. He's like, I'm not saying go to law school on a whim. I'm saying maybe you should consider what are the things you want to do and how can you get there? And I spent a bunch of weeks actually thinking about that advice, talking it over with my husband and myself and having a lot of, you know, conversations about it and thinking about what it means to engage in adding value in a way that feels more like advocacy or seeking justice or engaging in meaningful change in some way. And it kind of like occurred to me, maybe I should go to law school. So I literally signed up for an LSAT class. The LSATs were being given like, I don't know, 6 or 7 weeks later. I signed up for an LSAT class. I took an LSAT class. I took the LSATs, applied to a number of different law schools in the geographic area that I knew that I needed to be and that I had wanted to be for a variety of different reasons. And then ended up getting accepted to a few different law schools and then picked Seton Hall School of Law, Seton Hall University School mm-hmm. of Law, which ended up being a very, very good match for me and started law school.
And then when you're in law school with the end ambition or end goal of like being a public defender, working for like, what was your, how did, let me rephrase the question. Did you know how you wanted to use that degree or what, where you intended to take it? And then where did you take it?
So not at the beginning. I knew that law school would be, you know, a very steep climb. As I mentioned, I wasn't the most academic of children, right, when I was little, but I really loved learning. And I did well. And so for me, law school was just kind of getting through that beginning hurdle of like, what is this? How do you do this? You know, so many people walk into law school and they're like, I'm going to go to a firm or I'm going to go to big law. And I walked in being like, I don't want to go to a firm, but I don't know exactly what I want to do. And the truth is that I was so fortunate to take a few different courses and classes with really fantastic people, people that I consider to be mentors and still do to this day. You know, one class was a federal judge who just, it was a persuasion and advocacy class. And she just helped me hone certain skills that I realized I had almost like a natural ability to hone. It was like a mix of the theater background and also the ability to understand what it means to advocate in a meaningful way that feels thorough and well thought out and in a way that takes your passion, but actually puts it in the right frame. And so for me, that class actually was one of the most impactful courses that I took because it was at that point where I said to myself, I want to be a prosecutor. Like I always knew that there was an element of wanting to seek justice, but to be able to say there is a role and a job and a potential thing for me to do that could utilize those skills and also be able to add in certain elements of like my psychology background, it was clear to me that I really wanted to go to a prosecutor's office. And I wasn't sure which one. And then I was fortunate to be accepted into the mock trial program at the law school. And the coach of the mock trial program was a former prosecutor from the Bronx District Attorney's Office. And she was fabulous. And she was also a mentor and somebody that, you know, I learned a tremendous amount from. And through those two experiences, I was able to really hone in on where do I want to go? What kind of, you know, DA's office or prosecutor's office do I want to go to? And what is it that I want to do there, right? It's not just about speaking in a courtroom. It's what is the work that I want to do and how do I do it? And so it was clear to me by my third year of law school that I wanted to work at a district attorney's office and that I really wanted to be at one of the New York district attorney's offices. And I think because of my connection to my mentor, my first choice was really the Bronx DA's office. It was just known to be a wonderful place to work with a tremendous amount of work to do. It was known to be just an ethical, like moral place where you were going to work hard and be thrown in, but that you were going to be working with amazing colleagues. And so I was fortunate, even in a recession, that I was accepted into that class when I graduated, and that I was able to start at the DA's office in the Bronx.
How important, because you mentioned your mentors there a couple of times. How important, this is just a general question, are and it can be for male or female, right? But we'll say a young woman growing up, how important is it to have advocates, mentors, supporters? Like talk a little bit about not only how that actually influenced like literally what you did from a, this is the direction that I want to go, or there are the opportunities that I see for myself, but how important was that from a confidence level, from a professional confidence level? Just talk a little bit about kind of your view on mentors or advocates or supporters early in career for someone.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hugely impactful. And I also think that mentors don't look the same to everyone. I think sometimes we have this idea that a mentor comes into your life and they become your guru, like your go-to person for everything, right? And you have to have that connection and relationship to them for the rest of your life. And I actually think what I have learned is that not only what I have learned, but also what I've seen as being impactful is that there are people that come into your lives at different stages that have a mentorship-like capacity. And that could be a week, and that could be a month, or it could be a decade. But the idea of being able to see yourself in a situation and acknowledge that there is someone that may be wiser, that may have real information to share with you, but also the ability to boost your confidence in that moment of time in your life, that can stay with you for forever. And so I always think that this word mentor is so big, right? Like we think about this as, I haven't found a mentor yet. If I haven't found a mentor, how will I ever do anything? And I always say to people, like, there are mentors throughout your whole life. It doesn't have to be this heavy lift of constantly, you know, seeing that person every single year. It has to be for this moment, in this week, in this month of my life, there is someone that shared something that guided me in some way, that inspired me in some way. And that moment had a trajectory in my life. So I think it's hugely important, but I also think it's hugely important that we redefine what a mentor truly is, and that it can also just be a moment in time.
I love everything that you just said, and you articulated it. My philosophy is pretty similar. You articulated it much better than I ever have. But this whole concept and idea of taking pieces from different people and then kind of learning, and to your point, one day, one week, a several year relationship, right? Whatever it is, but taking pieces and learning and applying it to what works for you, as opposed to, I think sometimes people get stuck, especially earlier in their career, and they're, I want to be like X, right? Instead of, I aspire to this certain aspect of this person or this certain trait, right? But then you're pulling a piece from somebody else to kind of make it organically you. So I love that you said that. And I love that it also can kind of weave in and out. It doesn't have to be a permanent fixed relationship for eternity. And that's okay. So
absolutely. Absolutely.
So talk through now, how you get from law school, and this might be describe it however you want it, whatever pace you want, but how do you get from your first job out of law school to starting a company?
Sure. So, you know, I never intended to start a company. I didn't see myself as an entrepreneur at all, or somebody that would ever have an interest in that. I always saw myself as part of like a larger team. I was at the DA's office for a number of years. I actually was at the DA's office in the Domestic Violence Bureau my first year, and then I was able to transfer over to the Child Abuse and Sex Crimes Bureau. And I was there for a few years, and then I took a break to move across the country for my husband's job. And when we came back to New York, I was able to come back to my position at the DA's office in the Child Abuse and Sex Crimes Bureau. I literally walked back into my office with my computer that still had all of my documents on it. I mean, literally walked right back into my old job. I was there for a number of years after that. When I left the DA's office, I started working for a company that had a pretty national/global reach. And I was working, it was an investigative company. And I was working in their sexual misconduct consulting and investigations division, where I ended up being a managing director, conducting large-scale historical abuse investigations into boundary crossing behavior, into grooming behavior, things like, you know, there might have been an allegation or something that had happened years back and law enforcement was not involved for a variety of reasons. And so, you know, the entity, whatever it might be, really wanted a full accounting of the abuse or the harassment that happened for the purpose and goal of being able to understand it and make sure it didn't happen again. And as part of that work, I also started doing a lot of public speaking, something that I had always done prior and had done a lot of public speaking within my own community and within my own, you know, house of worship and other ones of that sort. But I was able to really focus on, we've done this large scale investigation. How do we then take the lessons learned and make sure it doesn't happen again, right? Or how do we make ourselves safer? How do we make our schools, our camps safer? And so a big piece of what I started to do there was this public speaking component of abuse prevention and harassment prevention and safe practices. And so it ended up being this kind of natural progression when I got to a point where I really needed to pause doing investigations. You know, you do investigations for over a decade, it weighs on you in a different way. And I think for me, I knew enough to know that the preventative piece, the how do we work to prevent this, was really where my passion was after so many years of doing investigations, that I really wanted to essentially be able to focus on that and focus on that in a variety of different ways, right? And so there was this natural progression to stopping the investigatory work and to be able to say, how do I build something that will allow me to, you know, travel the country and really work with so many entities that, you know, wouldn't have done this work or implemented this work. And so I focused my business trajectory on a combination of both youth-facing places as well as corporate places. And so for those youth-facing places, focusing on schools and camps and youth organizations, sports organizations, anything that is youth-oriented, and really working strategically on moving away from this check the box of like, yeah, we prevent abuse because we do a video, you know, like, or yeah, we get harassment. We have this, you know, video that we watch, and really be able to say like, okay, everyone, let's take a step back. In order to really create an environment that is free from any form of sexual abuse or harassment, we actually have to understand it. We have to understand how it works, how it's able to thrive, why people are silent about it, why they don't disclose it. And we have to realize that protecting kids, it's not actually the burden of the kid to keep themselves safe. It's the burden of the adults in this place to work to keep kids safe. So what that looks like is in any youth-facing place, you know, there are places that I go to multiple times a year to run workshops. I do trainings and workshops for kids, for parents, for staff, and for faculty. I get to work with a lot of summer camps in the summer and go and conduct their staff training, which is always awesome because I love summer camp. And in the corporate sector, a lot of what that looks like really comes out of the Me Too movement of, you know, how do we create a space that feels free of harassment? How do we really think about sexual harassment beyond the required, you know, hour-long video that you have to watch every single year? How do we have tough conversations about what it means to not have to engage with unwelcome behavior? And why is it that we have to shift the lens from this check the box to a place of recognizing that irrespective of gender or identity or whoever you might be, many, many people have experienced harassment in the workplace, and can't we do better? And so that ability to kind of bring the lens of having prosecuted sex crimes and child abuse for a number of years, and also having worked in the investigative field, kind of picking up the pieces when conducting an investigation, has also given me the ability to have the insight to say, how do we do this well?
What is you, thank you for that overview. You touched on a bunch of things. I have three or four follow-up questions to that. So I'll try to organize my thoughts here. What would you say is the common theme around, why it's maybe not talked about, why, you know, there is the check the box or show the video, like what themes in your experience have you noticed that where companies have it wrong and have to do better, even if they have good intent?
I think that when we focus on abuse and harassment prevention solely from the perspective of liability, risk mitigation, insurance, and the financial aspect of it, you lose sight of what you're really talking about, which is what it means to be a person, come to our workplace or come to a youth-oriented program and know that like you have a right to be there and to thrive there. And it's not just about a laundry list of don'ts. It's about what is the environment that is being created. And so I think that a lot of times when it comes to like the harassment work that I do in the more corporate sector, for so many years, it was just about HR compliance. It was just about ensuring that like, you know, from an employment perspective, we don't get sued, or, you know, we don't have to do a payout, or, you know, yes, we want to mitigate the risk, but we want to mitigate the risk from the perspective of finances, as opposed to mitigating the risk from the perspective of environment created. And I think that that shift allows any workplace to say, well, then that means we have to do more than just a 45-minute video, right? We actually have to engage in meaningful scenario-based work or conversations and really be able to hear from people, what is your experience? What has your experience been? And what can we do to help change a culture or help tighten up a culture and make it better? And I think from the child-facing perspective, when it comes to sexual abuse, nobody wants to talk about it because it's scary and it's uncomfortable. And because we're caught in a lot of these myths that exist that, like, you would just be able to tell if something bad was happening because the person who's doing it would seem like scary or creepy or off, right? They would seem as though they're the type of person that you'd see on an episode of Law and Order and be like, that's the person who's doing something bad. But what we've learned time and time again is that, especially in a child-facing place, you know, in order to sexually abuse a kid, you have to have access to kids. You have to be good with kids. You have to fly under the creepy radar, because no one's going to purposely bring a creepy person in to work with kids. So that means that when we really think about mitigating the risk and saving lives, we have to think about it from the perspective, not just of compliance, but of depth. What is the depth of what we are doing, and how are we doing it to empower the adults to keep everybody safe?
And is that something, once you have the audience, is that usually well understood and well received, or is it, since it's such a complex, complex is probably the wrong word, intense topic, is it, and probably uncomfortable for a lot of people, is it often well received? Is it, does it take time for people to warm up to the concept? What's your kind of path of that?
Yeah, I use a lot of stories and anecdotes. I mean, there are always moments in any of my workshops or presentations where people are laughing. You know, I put a lot of humor into what it is that we're doing, not for the purpose of ever making light, but to be able to shed light on certain things. And so I think that, you know, one of the things that I've really focused on is that these are scary topics, but we don't have to be scared by them. We can actually be empowered by them. And so my, you know, mantra or ethos, you know, whichever word describes it, is very much about saying, how do we empower the people around us to recognize that this is my space? I want this to be safe. What can I do to be able to add value, to be able to understand these concepts? And instead of sitting in fear about them, how do I become an empowered part of the solution? And so I think that a lot of my workshops and my public speaking and the things that I do are really focused on that. And the truth is that when you empower adults to have this knowledge, right? When you empower kids to have this knowledge, there actually is an element of risk mitigation, right? You are working together to keep these issues far away from your place, but you're not doing it from a place of fear. And I think that that's something that is really, really important from my perspective.
And how do you, this is more on a personal note, you know, again, it's heavy subject matter. How do you personally, is that a heavy load to carry for you? I mean, the emotional weight of doing that work, is that a heavy load? You know, I always think of this when people doing, are dealing with just intense and complex human subject matter, right? That they take that, you know, we're all human, right? It's not like you leave a building and leave that, you know, in the building and just go home, or maybe you do. How do you carry the emotional weight of doing that work, or does it not affect you outside of, can you separate it? You know, the work that you do just in your personal life, or how do you balance and can't manage the weight?
I exercise a lot. No, you know, I think that when I was a prosecutor, I learned very early on how important being able to compartmentalize was. And yet at the same time, you are an empathetic person and you are somebody that, You know, you have to be trauma-informed. You're navigating the most complex, horrific moments of people's lives, right? Like, you know, there would be times when I would be asking a child to share something that had happened that was the most traumatic moment of their life, right? My face is associated with asking horrific questions, right? Whether it's in a grand jury or on a trial or just in my office with regard to trial prep. And, you know, there are certain cases that will never leave me. You know, there are certain, you know, I'm sure that there could be a study done for prosecutors on like the things that they've seen, whether it's crime scenes or video footage or, you know, just the recitation of information from victims and survivors. And there are times when I was a prosecutor where I would come home and just need to like shower the day off, you know, and figure out how to be able to compartmentalize better. And I think that as, you know, I continue to do work in this field, there comes this point where working in sex crimes, working in the field of sexual misconduct and child safety, you really have to be able to separate. And you have to be able to come at what it is you're doing, both from a trauma-informed lens and from an empathetic place, but also from a place of like, I can't lose myself in it. Because if I lose myself in it, I can't parent my children, right? I can't be a spouse to my partner. I can't function in terms of my own life. And so I think that sometimes some months are easier than others. I started by jokingly saying like I exercise a lot, but the truth is that I think that for me has really been able to be an outlet of both keeping myself, you know, healthy and sane, but also having something that I focus on that makes me feel good, right? When it comes to every single day and every single day of doing this work. And I also think that the minute that anybody who works in this field starts to be bogged down by it in a way that doesn't allow them to function, it's time to say, I need to break, like I need to stop, because nobody should be giving everything of themselves to the work that they do as a professional, so much so that they lose themselves in the process. I will also say that, you know, my kids joke all the time, like, people know who their mother is, right? Like, you know, when somebody, you know, whether it's in their school or their camp or, you know, whatever it might be, I think that sometimes my kids may carry the burden of having me as a parent. And at the same time, like we talk about it a lot. We have conversations about it a lot and we have open communication about it. Especially when I'm like asked to come in and do training at their schools or like their camps or, you know, things of that sort. And I also think a sense of humor is really necessary, right? Like there are things that you can't integrate your humor into. And then there are things where you could like take a step back and say like, okay, you know, and breathe. It's hard, but it is doable.
How do you taking out the subject matter that you deal with, just from a level of, I'll call it work-life integration, right? Running a business, having a family, having other priorities. Talk a little bit about just your experience with that. I say integration versus balance. That's my choice of words to how I like to articulate it. But talk about that, running a business, having a family. You know, do you feel like you're doing a great job some places and not a great job other places, like from the actual business component to family component? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, I think that, you know, I started my business during COVID, and I think that it would be, disingenuous to say that that didn't have an impact on how I structured the business, right? I have a home office. I work from my home, right? Like, unless I am traveling, which I do a lot, you know, I'm home. And so I think that that piece of it has allowed me to figure out what I need to do to balance in terms of every day or every week. But it's hard. You know, anybody who like, you know, works in my kids' schools, for example, knows that like I'll ask for school calendar years like a year in advance, right? Because I'm setting my travel calendar and I need to make sure I'm not going to miss a play, an open night, you know, a parent-teacher conference. And so I will put things on my calendar like a year in advance, hoping that it doesn't change. because I'm booking travel, you know. I think that one of the things about being a business owner that includes consulting and public speaking where I am traveling is that I make my travel schedule. It also means I make my vacation schedule. And I am very specific about when I have vacation or time leading up to a vacation, I do not shift that, right? So that piece of it, being able to say, if I know that on, you know, Thursday nights or Tuesday nights, each of my kid has a different extracurricular activity, and we need every adult on hand to get them to every single place, then my calls stop at 3 o'clock, right? So there is an element of you, when you're a business owner, making your own schedule. At the same time, for anybody who's listening, boundaries are really hard. How many times have I like been putting a kid to sleep or helping with homework where I say to myself, I really just need to get this one thing done. I could run upstairs and do it. I just need to do it, right? And it almost becomes, if I don't do it, then my day hasn't worked out well. And that's something that I feel like I'm continuously working on, being able to set those boundaries, being able to ensure that they stay consistent. It is not perfect. And I think that one of the things that I did at the beginning of my business is basically for the first 9 months of my business, I did everything on my own. I did everything: bookkeeping, accounting, invoicing. I learned how to do it, right? I did everything in terms of, you know, drafting every single retainer agreement, you know, putting everything together, all of my social media. I did everything on my own to learn the business. And then when I got to a point where I felt like I can do all of this, I started to outsource the things that were taking up my time in a way that I didn't need my time taken up. So I have a bookkeeper and I have an accountant, right? And I have an attorney and I have, you know, I have somebody who manages my social media and I have admin help. And I think that being able to trust the people around you so that you can do the meaningful work you have to do is also an important piece of keeping boundaries.
I love that. I have two more questions and we'll get to kind of rapid fire. What advice would you give your younger self?
The reason why I'm pausing is because my younger self would not have listened. I'm being honest. I just, you know, there's a part of me as a middle-aged individual who basically wants to say to my younger self, like, it's going to work out. It's going to be awesome. Like, it's going to work out. And yet at the same time, I think the only reason why it worked out is because of how much resilience needed to be built and how many hills needed to be climbed in order to get to this place. And so I want to say it'll all work out, but I actually also want to send the message. It's a process. You have to trust the process. You have to take the risks. You have to fail. You have to have resilience. You have to cry. Like, you have to ask for help when needed. It's not just that it's all going to work out because it's simple. It is not going to be simple, but it is doable and you will see it. You will see it.
And how do you define, my last question, how do you define success?
Oh boy. Okay. I think at this point in my life, and I want to be clear on that because I think success is different at every point in your life. I think at this point in my life, success is about feeling a little bit whole, like feeling like my work matters and I love it, but also feeling like it doesn't take away from my family and being able to raise my family and feeling like it's okay to say no to something and it's important to say no to things. And it's also important to recognize that feeling whole doesn't mean that every day is perfect. And if you can go to sleep at the end of the day filled with stress and anxiety, that's the reality of some days. And if you can go to bed at the end of the day feeling good about that day, that's also the way that a day can feel. And so success is about knowing that all of those different feelings are normal, but also still being able to do something that is meaningful during the time that you are doing it. I hope that was clear. I was just thinking, you know, out of turn with regard to how it's so hard to define it.
Well, it is. I mean, it is, because it's interesting. It's also, and I love the way that you answered the question. It's interesting too, because people answer it in different ways, which I think is also, you know, just human nature, right? Different approaches to things. I love that you answered it from the whole person, human perspective, right? And integrating different parts into it. You know, some people answer that or see it different ways, right?
Right.
Monetary, career, family only. I love the way that you answered the question. I'm going to get to rapid fire questions here in a second. Before we do that though, and rapid fire is totally unrelated to anything that we talked about. It's like this or that.
But
before we get to that, let the audience know how they can find you, how they can get in touch with you. Where can they learn more about you and the work that you do?
So our website is The Bayer Group, spelled THEBAYAR group.com. And you can get a lot of information there on all the socials. The Bayer Group has a Facebook group, BAYAR group. On Instagram, we're actually under my name, Rachel.Bayer. So that is RAHEL.BAYAR. We share a lot of tips, especially for guardians, caregivers, parents, grandparents, et cetera, on keeping kids safe. On LinkedIn, I'm under my name, as well as the Bayer Group, and you should feel free to reach out.
Perfect. Perfect. And is there anything else before I get to rapid fire, anything else that you want to mention or cover that we haven't talked about?
No, thank you so much for having me. Now I'm like the right amounts of both nervous and excited for rapid fire. So let's do it.
All right, here we go. I hope it doesn't disappoint. Brick or stone?
Stone.
Pizza or pasta?
Pizza.
Netflix or Hulu?
Oh boy, Netflix.
Winter or summer?
Winter.
Real books, hardback, paperback books? Or
real
audio
books.
Or
real books.
I couldn't even get to the audiobooks.
Real books.
I am with you. I am with you. People are like, oh, I read a book. But then they're like, well, an audiobook. I'm like, yeah, it's not reading, but okay. West Coast or East Coast?
East Coast.
East Coast. All right. And last one, two more. Grass or sky?
Sky.
Astronaut, the final one, astronaut or deep sea diver?
Astronaut.
All right. Perfect. Thank you. Thank you so much for being a guest. This was wonderful. I really, really enjoyed talking with you. I learned a bunch of stuff. Very educational, very insightful. And I love your energy too. Even through the computer, I can feel your warmth and your energy. So I very much enjoyed this conversation.
Well, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure. Really.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Again, my guest is Rachel Bayer, and she's the owner of The Bayer Group. And this is the Lauren Asghari podcast, How'd Her Career Get There? And we'll see you next time.
Let's talk a bunch of different topics.
How'd her career get there?
This is a podcast with Lauren Asghari.